got his rights. But you're not a man. You're a beast. Wait till I get back to Dawson, Beauty Smith threatened. I'll have the law on you. If you open your mouth when you get back to Dawson, I'll have you run out of town. Understand? Beauty Smith replied with a grunt. Understand? The other thundered with abrupt fierceness. Yes, Beauty Smith grunted, shrinking away. Yes, what? Yes, sir, Beauty Smith snarled. Look out, he'll bite, someone shouted, and a guffaw of laughter went up. Scott turned his back on him and returned to help the dog musher who was working over White Fang. Some of the men were already departing. Others stood in groups, looking on and talking. Tim Keenan joined one of the groups.
Who's that mug?
He asked.
A Whedon Scott, someone answered.
And who in hell is Whedon Scott?
The faro dealer demanded.
Oh, one of them crackerjack mining experts. He's in with all the big bugs. If you want to keep out of trouble, you'll steer clear of him. That's my talk. He's all hunky with the officials. The gold commissioner's a special pal of his.
I thought he must be somebody,
was the faro dealer's comment.
That's why I kept my hands off of him at the start.
Chapter 5 The Indomitable.
It's hopeless, Whedon Scott confessed.
He sat on the step of his cabin and stared at the dog musher, who responded with a shrug that was equally hopeless. Together they looked at White Fang at the end of his stretched chain, bristling, snarling, ferocious, straining to get at the sled dogs. Having received sundry lessons from Matt, said lessons being imparted by means of a club, the sled dogs had learned to leave White Fang alone, and even then they were lying down at a distance, apparently oblivious of his existence.
"It's a wolf, and there's no taming it,"
Whedon Scott announced.
"Oh, I don't know about that," Matt objected. "Might be a lot of dog in him, for all you can tell, but there's one thing I know sure, and that there's no getting away from."
The dog musher paused and nodded his head confidentially at Moose Hide Mountain.
"Well, don't be a miser with what you know," Scott said sharply after waiting a suitable length of time. "Spit it out. What is it?"
The dog musher indicated White Fang with a backward thrust of his thumb.
"Wolf or dog, it's all the same. He's been tamed. Ready."
"No. I tell you, yes, and broken to harness. Look close there. Do you see them marks across the chest?"
"Oh, you're right, Matt.
He was a sled dog before Beauty Smith got hold of him. And there's not much reason against his being a sled dog again."
"Well, what do you think?"
Scott queried eagerly. Then the hope died down as he added, shaking his head,
"We've had him 2 weeks now, and if anything, he's wilder than ever at the present moment."
"Give him a chance," Matt counseled. "Turn him loose for a spell."
The other looked at him incredulously.
"Yes," Matt went on. "I know you've tried to, but you didn't take a club."
"You try it, then."
The dog musher secured a club and went over to the chained animal. White Fang watched the club after the manner of a caged lion watching the whip of its trainer.
"See him keep his eye on that club?" Matt said. "That's a good sign. He's no fool. Don't dast tackle me so long as I got that club handy. He's not clean crazy, sure."
As the man's hand approached his neck, White Fang bristled and snarled and crouched down. But while he eyed the approaching hand, he at the same time contrived to keep track of the club in the other hand, suspended threateningly above him. Matt unsnapped the chain from the collar and stepped back. White Fang could scarcely realize that he was free. Many months had gone by since he passed into the possession of Beauty Smith, and in all that period he had never known a moment of freedom, except at the times he had been loose to fight with other dogs. Immediately after such fights he had always been imprisoned again. He did not know what to make of it. Perhaps some new devilry of the gods was about to be perpetrated on him. He walked slowly and cautiously, prepared to be assailed at any moment. He did not know what to do. It was all so unprecedented. He took the precaution to sheer off from the two watching guards and walked carefully to the corner of the cabin. Nothing happened. He was plainly perplexed, and he came back again, pausing a dozen feet away and regarding the two men intently.
"Won't he run away?" his new owner asked. Matt shrugged his shoulders.
"Gotta take a gamble. Only way to find out is to find out."
"Poor devil," Scott murmured pityingly. "What he needs is some show of human kindness," he added, turning and going into the cabin.
He came out with a piece of meat, which he tossed to White Fang. He sprang away from it and from a distance studied it suspiciously.
"Hi, you, Major!"
Matt shouted warningly, but too late. Major had made a spring for the meat. At the instant his jaws closed on it, White Fang struck him. He was overthrown. Matt rushed in, but quicker than he was White Fang. Major staggered to his feet, but the blood spouting from his throat reddened the snow in a widening path.
"It's too bad, but it served him right," Scott said hastily.
But Matt's foot had already started on its way to kick White Fang. There was a leap, a flash of teeth, a sharp exclamation. White Fang, snarling fiercely, scrambled backward for several yards, while Matt stooped and investigated his leg.
"He got me all right,"
he announced, pointing to the torn trousers and underclothes and the growing stain of red.
"I told you it was hopeless, Matt," Scott said in a discouraged voice. "I've thought about it off and on while not wanting to think of it, but we've come to it now. It's the only thing to do."
As he talked, with reluctant movements, he drew his revolver, threw open the cylinder, and assured himself of its contents.
"Look here, Mr. Scott," Matt objected. "That dog's been through hell. You can't expect him to come out a white and shining angel. Give him time."
"Look at Major," the other rejoined.
The dog musher surveyed the stricken dog. He had sunk down on the snow in the circle of his blood and was plainly in the last gasp.
"Served him right. You said so yourself, Mr. Scott. He tried to take White Fang's meat, and he's dead-o. That was to be expected. I wouldn't give two whoops in hell for a dog that wouldn't fight for his own meat."
"But look at yourself, Matt. It's all right about the dogs, but we must draw the line somewhere."
"Served me right," Matt argued stubbornly. "What did I want to kick him for? You said yourself that he'd done right. Then I had no right to kick him."
"It would be a mercy to kill him," Scott insisted. "He's untamable.
Now look here, Mr. Scott, give the poor devil a fighting chance. He ain't had no chance yet. He's just come through hell, and this is the first time he's been loose. Give him a fair chance, and if you don't deliver the goods, I'll kill him myself. There."
"God knows I don't want to kill him or have him killed," Scott answered, putting away the revolver. "We'll let him run loose and see what kindness can do for him, and here's a try at it."
He walked over to White Fang and began talking to him gently and soothingly.
"Better have a club handy," Matt warned.
Scott shook his head and went on trying to win White Fang's confidence. White Fang was suspicious. Something was impending. He had killed this god's dog, bitten his companion god, and what else was to be expected than some terrible punishment? But in the face of it, he was indomitable. He bristled and showed his teeth, his eyes vigilant, his whole body wary and prepared for anything. The god had no club, so he suffered him to approach quite near. The god's hand had come out and was descending upon his head. White Fang shrank together and grew tense as he crouched under it. Here was danger, some treachery or something. He knew the hands of the gods, their proved mastery, their cunning to hurt. Besides, there was his old antipathy to being touched. He snarled more menacingly, crouched still lower, and still the hand descended. He did not want to bite the hand, and he endured the peril of it until his instinct surged up in him, mastering him with its insatiable yearning for life. Whedon Scott had believed that he was quick enough to avoid any snap or slash, but he had yet to learn the remarkable quickness of White Fang, who struck with the certainty and swiftness of a coiled snake. Scott cried out sharply with surprise, catching his torn hand and holding it tightly in his other hand. Matt uttered a great oath and sprang to his side. White Fang crouched down and backed away, bristling, showing his fangs, his eyes malignant with menace. Now he could expect a beating as fearful as any he had received from Beauty Smith.
"Here, what are you doing?"
Scott cried suddenly. Matt had dashed into the cabin and come out with a rifle.
"Nothing," he said slowly, with a careless calmness that was assumed. "Only going to keep that promise I made. I reckon it's up to me to kill him as I said I'd do." "No, you don't." "Yes, I do. Watch me."
As Matt had pleaded for White Fang when he had been bitten, it was now Whedon Scott's turn to plead.
"You said to give him a chance. Well, give it to him. We've only just started, and we can't quit at the beginning. It served me right this time. And look at him."
White Fang, near the corner of the cabin and 40 feet away, was snarling with blood-curdling viciousness, not at Scott, but at the dog musher.
"Well, I'll be everlastingly gosh-swoggled," was the dog musher's expression of astonishment.
"Look at the intelligence of him," Scott went on hastily. "He knows the meaning of firearms as well as you do. He's got intelligence, and we've got to give that intelligence a chance. Put up the gun."
"All right, I'm willing," Matt agreed,
leaning the rifle against the woodpile.
"But will you look at that?" he exclaimed the next moment.
White Fang had quieted down and ceased snarling.
"This is worth investigating. Watch."
Matt reached for the rifle, and at the same moment White Fang snarled. He stepped away from the rifle, and White Fang's lifted lips descended, covering his teeth.
"Now, just for fun."
Matt took the rifle and began slowly to raise it to his shoulder. White Fang's snarling began with a movement and increased as the movement approached its culmination. But the moment before the rifle came to a level on him, he leapt sideways behind the corner of the cabin. Matt stood staring along the sights at the empty space of snow which had been occupied by White Fang. The dog musher put the rifle down solemnly, then turned and looked at his employer.
"I agree with you, Mr. Scott. That dog's too intelligent to kill."
Chapter 6. The Love Master. As White Fang watched Whedon Scott approach, he bristled and snarled to advertise that he would not submit to punishment. 24 hours had passed since he had slashed open the hand that was now bandaged and held up by a sling to keep the blood out of it. In the past, White Fang had experienced delayed punishments, and he apprehended that such a one was about to befall him. How could it be otherwise? He had committed what was to him sacrilege, sunk his fangs into the holy flesh of a god, and of a white-skinned superior god at that. In the nature of things, and of intercourse with gods, something terrible awaited him. The god sat down several feet away. White Fang could see nothing dangerous in that. When the gods administered punishment, they stood on their legs. Besides, this god had no club, no whip, no firearm. And furthermore, he himself was free. No chain nor stick bound him. He could escape into safety while the god was scrambling to his feet. In the meantime, he would wait and see. The god remained quiet, made no movement, and White Fang's snarl slowly dwindled to a growl that ebbed down in his throat and ceased. Then the god spoke, and at the first sound of his voice, the hair rose on White Fang's neck, and the growl rushed up in his throat. But the god made no hostile movement, and went on calmly talking. For a time, White Fang growled in unison with him, a correspondence of rhythm being established between growl and voice. But the god talked on interminably. He talked to White Fang as White Fang had never been talked to before. He talked softly and soothingly, with a gentleness that somehow, somewhere, touched White Fang. In spite of himself and all the pricking warnings of his instinct, White Fang began to have confidence in this god. He had a feeling of security that was belied by all his experience with men. After a long time, the god got up and went into the cabin. White Fang scanned him apprehensively when he came out. He had neither whip, nor club, nor weapon, nor was his uninjured hand behind his back hiding something. He sat down as before, in the same spot, several feet away. He held out a small piece of meat. White Fang pricked his ears and investigated it suspiciously, managing to look at the same time both at the meat and the god, alert for any overt act, his body tense and ready to spring away at the first sign of hostility. Still, the punishment delayed. The god merely held near to his nose a piece of meat, and about the meat there seemed nothing wrong. Still, White Fang suspected, and though the meat was proffered to him with short, inviting thrusts of the hand, he refused to touch it. The gods were all wise, and there was no telling what masterful treachery lurked behind that apparently harmless piece of meat. In past experience, especially in dealing with squaws, meat and punishment had often been disastrously related. In the end, the god tossed the meat on the snow at White Fang's feet. He smelled the meat carefully, but he did not look at it. While he smelled it, he kept his eyes on the god. Nothing happened. He took the meat into his mouth and swallowed it. Still, nothing happened. The god was actually offering him another piece of meat. Again, he refused to take it from the hand, and again it was tossed to him. This was repeated a number of times, but there came a time when the god refused to toss it. He kept it in his hand and steadfastly proffered it. The meat was good meat, and White Fang was hungry. Bit by bit, infinitely cautious, he approached the hand. At last, the time came that he decided to eat the meat from the hand. He never took his eyes from the god, thrusting his head forward with ears flattened back and hair involuntarily rising and cresting on his neck. Also, a low growl rumbled in his throat as warning that he was not to be trifled with. He ate the meat, and nothing happened. Piece by piece, he ate all the meat, and nothing happened. Still, the punishment delayed. He licked his chops and waited. The god went on talking. In his voice was kindness, something of which White Fang had no experience whatever. And within him it aroused feelings which he had likewise never experienced before. He was aware of a certain strange satisfaction, as though some need were being gratified, as though some void in his being were being filled. Then again came the prod of his instinct and the warning of past experience. The gods were ever crafty, and they had unguessed ways of attaining their ends. Ah, he had thought so. There it came now, the god's hand, cunning to hurt, thrusting out at him, descending upon his head. But the god went on talking. His voice was soft and soothing. In spite of the menacing hand, the voice inspired confidence, and in spite of the assuring voice, the hand inspired distrust. White Fang was torn by conflicting feelings, impulses. It seemed he would fly to pieces, so terrible was the control he was exerting, holding together by an unwanted indecision the counterforces that struggled within him for mastery. He compromised. He snarled and bristled and flattened his ears, but he neither snapped nor sprang away. The hand descended. Nearer and nearer it came. It touched the ends of his upstanding hair. He shrank down under it. It followed down after him, pressing more closely against him. Shrinking, almost shivering, he still managed to hold himself together. It was a torment, this hand that touched him and violated his instinct. He could not forget in a day all the evil that had been wrought him at the hands of men. But it was the will of the god, and he strove to submit. The hand lifted and descended again, in a patting, caressing movement. This continued, but every time the hand lifted, the hair lifted under it. And every time the hand descended, the ears flattened down and a cavernous growl surged in his throat. White Fang growled and growled with insistent warning. By this means he announced that he was prepared to retaliate for any hurt he might receive. There was no telling when the god's ulterior motive might be disclosed. At any moment that soft, confidence-inspiring voice might break forth in a roar of wrath, that gentle and caressing hand transform itself into a vice-like grip to hold him helpless and administer punishment. But The god talked on softly, and ever the hand rose and fell with non-hostile pats. White Fang experienced dual feelings. It was distasteful to his instinct. It restrained him, opposed the will of him toward personal liberty. And yet it was not physically painful. On the contrary, it was even pleasant, in a physical way. The patting movement slowly and carefully changed to a rubbing of the ears about their bases, and the physical pleasure even increased a little. Yet he continued to fear, and he stood on guard, expectant of unguessed evil, alternately suffering and enjoying as one feeling or the other came uppermost and swayed him. "Well, I'll be gosh swoggled," so spoke Matt, coming out of the cabin, his sleeves rolled up, a pan of dirty dishwater in his hands, arrested in the act of emptying the pan by the sight of Whedon Scott patting White Fang. At the instant his voice broke the silence, White Fang leaped back, snarling savagely at him. Matt regarded his employer with grieved disapproval.
"If you don't mind my expressing my feelings, Mr. Scott, I'll make free to say you're 17 kinds of a damn fool and all of 'em different and then some."
Whedon Scott smiled with a superior air, gained his feet, and walked over to White Fang. He talked soothingly to him, but not for long, then slowly put out his hand, rested it on White Fang's head, and resumed the interrupted patting. White Fang endured it, keeping his eyes fixed suspiciously, not upon the man that patted him, but upon the man that stood in the doorway.
"You may be a number one tip-top mining expert, all right, all right," the dog musher delivered himself oracularly. "But you missed the chance of your life when you was a boy and didn't run off and join a circus."
White Fang snarled at the sound of his voice, but this time did not leap away from under the hand that was caressing his head and the back of his neck with long, soothing strokes. It was the beginning of the end for White Fang, the ending of the old life and the reign of hate. A new and incomprehensibly fairer life was dawning. It required much thinking and endless patience on the part of Whedon Scott to accomplish this, and on the part of White Fang it required nothing less than a revolution. He had to ignore the urges and promptings of instinct and reason, defy experience, give the lie to life itself. Life, as he had known it, not only had had no place in it for much that he now did, but all the currents had gone counter to those to which he now abandoned himself. In short, when all things were considered, he had to achieve an orientation far vaster than the one he had achieved at the time he came voluntarily in from the wild and accepted Grey Beaver as his lord. At that time he was a mere puppy, soft from the making, without form, ready for the thumb of circumstance to begin its work upon him. But now it was different. The thumb of circumstance had done its work only too well. By it he had been formed and hardened into the fighting wolf, fierce and implacable, unloving and unlovable. To accomplish the change was like a reflux of being, and this when the plasticity of youth was no longer his, when the fiber of him had become tough and knotty, when the warp and the wolf of him had made of him an adamantine texture, harsh and unyielding, when the face of his spirit had become iron, and all his instincts and axioms had crystallized into set rules, cautions, dislikes, and desires. Yet again, in this new orientation, it was the thumb of circumstance that pressed and prodded him, softening that which had become hard and remolding it into fairer form. Whedon Scott was, in truth, this thumb. He had gone to the roots of White Fang's nature, and with kindness touched to life potencies that had languished and well-nigh perished. One such potency was love. It took the place of like, which latter had been the highest feeling that thrilled him in his intercourse with the gods. But this love did not come in a day. It began with like, and out of it slowly developed. White Fang did not run away, though he was allowed to remain loose, because he liked this new god. This was certainly better than the life he had lived in the cage of Beauty Smith, and it was necessary that he should have some god. The lordship of man was a need of his nature. The seal of his dependence on man had been set upon him in that early day when he turned his back on the wild and crawled to Grey Beaver's feet to receive the expected beating. This seal had been stamped upon him again, and ineradicably on his second return from the wild, when the long famine was over and there was fish once more in the village of Grey Beaver. And so, because he needed a god, and because he preferred Whedon Scott to Beauty Smith, White Fang remained. In acknowledgment of fealty, he proceeded to take upon himself the guardianship of his master's property. He prowled about the cabin while the sled dog slept, and the first night visitor to the cabin fought him off with a club until Whedon Scott came to the rescue. But White Fang soon learned to differentiate between thieves and honest men, to appraise the true value of step and carriage. The man who traveled, loud-stepping, the direct line to the cabin door, he let alone, though he watched him vigilantly until the door opened and he received the endorsement of the master. But the man who went softly, by circuitous ways, peering with caution, seeking after secrecy, that was the man who received no suspension of judgment from White Fang, and who went away abruptly, hurriedly, and without dignity. Whedon Scott had set himself the task of redeeming White Fang, or rather of redeeming mankind from the wrong it had done White Fang. It was a matter of principle and conscience. He felt that the ill done White Fang was a debt incurred by man, and that it must be paid. So he went out of his way to be especially kind to the fighting wolf. Each day he made it a point to caress and pet White Fang, and to do it at length. At first suspicious and hostile, White Fang grew to like this petting, but there was one thing that he never outgrew, his growling. Growl he would, from the moment the petting began till it ended, but it was a growl with a new note in it. A stranger could not hear this note, and to such a stranger the growling of White Fang was an exhibition of primordial savagery, nerve-racking and blood-curdling. But White Fang's throat had become harsh-fibered from the making of ferocious sounds through the many years since his first little rasp of anger in the lair of his cubhood, and he could not soften the sounds of that throat now to express the gentleness he felt. Nevertheless, Whedon Scott's ear and sympathy were fine enough to catch the new note, all but drowned in the fierceness. The note that was the faintest hint of a croon of content, and that none but he could hear. As the days went by, the evolution of like into love was accelerated. White Fang himself began to grow aware of it, though in his consciousness he knew not what love was. It manifested itself to him as a void in his being, a hungry, aching, yearning void that clamored to be filled. It was a pain and an unrest, and it received easement only by the touch of the new god's presence. At such times, love was joy to him, a wild, keen, thrilling satisfaction. But when away from his god, the pain and the unrest returned. The void in him sprang up and pressed against him with its emptiness, and the hunger gnawed and gnawed unceasingly. White Fang was in the process of finding himself. In spite of the maturity of his years and of the savage rigidity of the mold that had formed him, his nature was undergoing an expansion. There was a burgeoning within him of strange feelings and unwonted impulses. His old code of conduct was changing. In the past he had liked comfort and surcease from pain, disliked discomfort and pain, and he had adjusted his actions accordingly. But now it was different. Because of this new feeling within him, he oft-times elected discomfort and pain for the sake of his god. Thus, in the early morning, instead of roaming and foraging or lying in a sheltered nook, he would wait for hours on the cheerless cabin stoop for a sight of the god's face. At night, when the god returned home, White Fang would leave the warm sleeping place he had burrowed in the snow in order to receive the friendly snap of fingers and the word of greeting. Meat itself he would forego to be with his god, to receive a caress from him, or to accompany him down into the town. Like had been replaced by love, and love was the plummet dropped down into the deeps of him where like had never gone. And responsive out of his deeps had come the new thing, love. That which was given unto him did he return. This was a god indeed, a love god, a warm and radiant god, in whose light White Fang's nature expanded as a flower expands under the sun. But White Fang was not demonstrative. He was too old, too firmly molded, to become adept at expressing himself in new ways. He was too self-possessed, too strongly poised in his own isolation. Too long had he cultivated reticence, aloofness, and moroseness. He had never barked in his life, and he could not now learn to bark a welcome when his god approached. He was never in the way, never extravagant nor foolish in the expression of his love. He never ran to meet his god. He waited at a distance. But he always waited, was always there. His love partook of the nature of worship, dumb, inarticulate, a silent adoration. Only by the steady regard of his eyes did he express his love, and by the unceasing following with his eyes of his god's every movement. Also at times, when his god looked at him and spoke to him, he betrayed an awkward self-consciousness caused by the struggle of his love to express itself and his physical inability to express it. He learned to adjust himself in many ways to his new mode of life. It was borne in upon him that he must let his master's dogs alone. Yet his dominant nature asserted itself, and he had first to thrash them into an acknowledgment of his superiority and leadership. This accomplished, he had little trouble with them. They gave trail to him when he came and went or walked among them, and when he asserted his will, they obeyed. In the same way he came to tolerate Matt as a possession of his master. His master rarely fed him. Matt did that. It was his business. Yet White Fang divined that it was his master's food he ate and that it was his master who thus fed him vicariously. Matt it was who tried to put him into the harness and make him haul sled with the other dogs, but Matt failed. It was not until Whedon Scott put the harness on White Fang and worked him that he understood. He took it as his master's will that Matt should drive him and work him just as he drove and worked his master's other dogs. Different from the Mackenzie toboggans were the Klondike sleds with runners under them, and different was the method of driving the dogs. There was no fan formation of the team. The dogs worked in single file, one behind another, hauling on double traces. And here, in the Klondike, the leader was indeed the leader. The wisest as well as strongest dog was the leader, and the team obeyed him and feared him. That White Fang should quickly gain this post was inevitable. He could not be satisfied with less, as Matt learned after much inconvenience and trouble. White Fang picked out the post for himself, and Matt backed his judgment with strong language after the experiment had been tried. But, though he worked in the sled in the day, White Fang did not forego the guarding of his master's property in the night. Thus he was on duty all the time, ever vigilant and faithful, the most valuable of all the dogs.
"Making free to spit out what's in me," Matt said one day. "I beg to state that you was a wise guy, all right, when you paid the price you did for that dog. You clean swindled Beauty Smith on top of pushing his face in with your fist."
A recrudescence of anger glinted in Whedon Scott's gray eyes, and he muttered savagely, "The beast." In the late spring, a great trouble came to White Fang. Without warning, the love master disappeared. There had been warning, but White Fang was unversed in such things and did not understand the packing of a grip. He remembered afterwards that his packing had preceded the master's disappearance, but at the time he suspected nothing. That night he waited for the master to return. At midnight, the chill wind that blew drove him to shelter at the rear of the cabin. There he drowsed, only half asleep, his ears keyed for the first sound of the familiar step. But at 2 in the morning, his anxiety drove him out to the cold front stoop, where he crouched and waited. But no master came. In the morning, the door opened and Matt stepped outside. White Fang gazed at him wistfully. There was no common speech by which he might learn what he wanted to know. The days came and went, but never the master. White Fang, who had never known sickness in his life, became sick. He became very sick, so sick that Matt was finally compelled to bring him inside the cabin. Also, in writing to his employer, Matt devoted a postscript to White Fang. Whedon Scott, reading the letter down in Circle City, came upon the following.
"That damn wolf won't work, won't eat, ain't got no spunk left. all the dogs is licking him. Wants to know what has become of you, and I don't know how to tell him. Maybe he is going to die."
It was as Matt had said. White Fang had ceased eating, lost heart, and allowed every dog of the team to thrash him. In the cabin he lay on the floor near the stove without interest in food, in Matt, nor in life. Matt might talk gently to him or swear at him, it was all the same. He never did more than turn his dull eyes upon the man, then drop his head back to its customary position on his forepaws. And then, one night, Matt, reading to himself with moving lips and mumbled sounds, was startled by a low whine from White Fang. He had got upon his feet, his ears cocked towards the door, and he was listening intently. A moment later, Matt heard a footstep. The door opened, and Whedon Scott stepped in. The two men shook hands. Then Scott looked around the room.
"Where's the wolf?"
he asked. Then he discovered him, standing where he had been lying, near to the stove. He had not rushed forward after the manner of other dogs. He stood, watching and waiting.
"Holy smoke!" Matt exclaimed. "Look at him wag his tail!"
Whedon Scott strode half across the room toward him, at the same time calling him. White Fang came to him, not with a great bound, yet quickly. He was awakened from self-consciousness, but as he drew near, his eyes took on a strange expression. Something, an incommunicable vastness of feeling, rose up into his eyes as a light and shone forth.
"He never looked at me that way all the time you was gone," Matt commented.
Whedon Scott did not hear. He was squatting down on his heels, face to face with White Fang, and petting him, rubbing at the roots of the ears, making long caressing strokes down the neck to the shoulders, tapping the spine gently with the balls of his fingers. And White Fang was growling responsively, the crooning note of the growl more pronounced than ever. But that was not all. What of his joy, the great love in him, ever surging and struggling to express itself, succeeding in finding a new mode of expression? He suddenly thrust his head forward and nudged his way in between the master's arm and body. And here, confined, hidden from view, all except his ears, no longer growling, he continued to nudge and snuggle. The two men looked at each other. Scott's eyes were shining.
"Gosh,"
said Matt in an awe-stricken voice. A moment later, when he had recovered himself, he said,
"I always insisted that wolf was a dog. Look at him."
With the return of the love master, White Fang's recovery was rapid. Two nights and a day he spent in the cabin. Then he sallied forth. The sled dogs had forgotten his prowess. They remembered only the latest, which was his weakness and sickness. At the sight of him, as he came out of the cabin, they sprang upon him.
"Talk about your rough houses," Matt murmured gleefully, standing in the doorway and looking on. "Give 'em hell, you wolf, give 'em hell, and then some."
White Fang did not need the encouragement. The return of the love master was enough. Life was flowing through him again, splendid and indomitable. He fought from sheer joy, finding in it an expression of much that he felt and that otherwise was without speech. There could be but one ending. The team dispersed in ignominious defeat, and it was not until after dark that the dogs came sneaking back, one by one, by meekness and humility, signifying their fealty to White Fang. Having learned to snuggle, White Fang was guilty of it often. It was the final word. He could not go beyond it. The one thing of which he had always been particularly jealous was his head. He had always disliked to have it touched. It was the wild in him, the fear of hurt and of the trap, that had given rise to the panicky impulses to avoid contacts. It was the mandate of his instinct that that head must be free. And now, with the love master, his snuggling was the deliberate act of putting himself into a position of hopeless helplessness. It was an expression of perfect confidence, of absolute self-surrender, as though he said, "I put myself into thy hands, work thou thy will with me." One night, not long after the return, Scott and Matt sat at a game of cribbage preliminary to going to bed.
15-2, 15-4, and a pair makes 6,
Matt was pegging up, when there was an outcry and sound of snarling without. They looked at each other as they started to rise to their feet.
"The wolf's nailed somebody," Matt said.
A wild scream of fear and anguish hastened them.
"Bring a light," Scott shouted as he sprang outside.
Matt followed with the lamp, and by its light they saw a man lying on his back in the snow. His arms were folded, one above the other, across his face and throat. Thus he was trying to shield himself from White Fang's teeth, and there was need for it. White Fang was in a rage, wickedly making his attack on the most vulnerable spot. From shoulder to wrist of the crossed arms, the coat sleeve, blue flannel shirt, and undershirt were ripped in rags, while the arms themselves were terribly slashed and streaming blood. All this the two men saw in the first instant. The next instant, Whedon Scott had White Fang by the throat and was dragging him clear. White Fang struggled and snarled but made no attempt to bite, while he quickly quieted down at a sharp word from the master. Matt helped the man to his feet. As he arose, he lowered his crossed arms, exposing the bestial face of Beauty Smith. The dog musher let go of him precipitately with action similar to that of a man who has picked up live fire. Beauty Smith blinked in the lamplight and looked about him. He caught sight of White Fang, and terror rushed into his face. At the same moment, Matt noticed two objects lying in the snow. He held the lamp close to them, indicating them with his toe for his employer's benefit. A steel dog chain and a stout club. Whedon Scott saw and nodded. Not a word was spoken. The dog musher laid his hand on Beauty Smith's shoulder and faced him to the right about. No word needed to be spoken. Beauty Smith started. In the meantime, the love master was patting White Fang and talking to him.
"Tried to steal you, huh? And you wouldn't have it. Well, well, he made a mistake, didn't he? Must have thought he had hold of 17 devils," the dog musher sniggered.
White Fang, still wrought up and bristling, growled and growled, the hair slowly lying down, the crooning note remote and dim, but growing in his throat. Part 5, Chapter 1, The Long Trail. It was in the air. White Fang sensed the coming calamity, even before there was tangible evidence of it. In vague ways, it was borne in upon him that a change was impending. He knew not how nor why, yet he got his feeling of the oncoming event from the gods themselves. In ways subtler than they knew, they betrayed their intentions to the wolf dog that haunted the cabin stoop, and that, though he never came inside the cabin, knew what went on inside their brains.
"Listen to that, will you?"
the dog musher exclaimed at supper one night. Whedon Scott listened. Through the door came a low, anxious whine, like a sobbing under the breath that had just grown audible. Then came the long sniff, as White Fang reassured himself that his god was still inside and had not yet taken himself off in mysterious and solitary flight.
"I do believe that wolf's on to you," the dog musher said.
Whedon Scott looked across at his companion with eyes that almost pleaded, though this was given the lie by his words.
"What the devil can I do with a wolf in California?" he demanded.
"That's what I say," Matt answered.
"What the devil can you do with a wolf in California?"
But this did not satisfy Whedon Scott. The other seemed to be judging him in a noncommittal sort of way.
"White man's dogs would have no show against him," Scott went on. "He'd kill them on sight if he didn't bankrupt me with damaged suits. The authorities would take him away from me and electrocute him."
"He's a downright murderer, I know," was the dog musher's comment.
Whedon Scott looked at him suspiciously.
"It would never do,"
he said decisively.
"It would never do," Matt concurred.
"Why, you'd have to hire a man specially to take care of him."
The other suspicion was allayed. He nodded cheerfully. In the silence that followed, the low, half-sobbing whine was heard at the door, and then the long, questing sniff.
"There's no denying he thinks a hell of a lot of you," Matt said.
The other glared at him in sudden wrath.
"Damn it all, man! I know my own mind and what's best!"
Oh, I'm agreeing with you. Only...
Only what? Scott snapped out.
Only... The dog musher began softly, then changed his mind and betrayed a rising anger of his own.
Well, you needn't get so all fired up about it. Judging by your actions, one would think you didn't know your own mind.
Whedon Scott debated with himself for a while and then said, more gently,
You are right, Matt. I don't know my own mind, and that's what's the trouble.
Why, it would be rank ridiculousness for me to take that dog along,
he broke out after another pause.
I'm agreeing with you,
was Matt's answer, and again his employer was not quite satisfied with him.
But how in the name of the great Sardanapalus he knows you're going is what gets me,
the dog musher continued innocently.
It's beyond me, Matt,
Scott answered, with a mournful shake of the head.
Then came the day when, through the open cabin door, White Fang saw the fatal grip on the floor and the Love Master packing things into it. Also, there were comings and goings, and the erstwhile placid atmosphere of the cabin was vexed with strange perturbations and unrest. Here was indubitable evidence. White Fang had already scented it. He now reasoned it. His god was preparing for another flight, and since he had not taken him with him before, so now he could look to be left behind. That night he lifted the long wolf howl, as he had howled in his puppy days when he fled back from the wild to the village to find it vanished and naught but a rubbish heap to mark the site of Grey Beaver's teepee. So now he pointed his muzzle to the cold stars and told to them his woe. Inside the cabin, the two men had just gone to bed.
"He's gone off his food again," Matt remarked from his bunk.
There was a grunt from Whedon Scott's bunk and a stir of blankets.
"From the way he cut up the other time you went away, I wouldn't wonder this time but that he died."
The blankets in the other bunk stirred irritably.
"Oh, shut up!" Scott cried out through the darkness. "You nag worse than a woman."
"I'm agreeing with you," the dog musher answered, and Whedon Scott was not quite sure whether or not the other had snickered.
The next day White Fang's anxiety and restlessness were even more pronounced. He dogged his master's heels whenever he left the cabin, and haunted the front stoop when he remained inside. Through the open door he could catch glimpses of the luggage on the floor. The grip had been joined by two large canvas bags and a box. Matt was rolling the master's blankets and fur robe inside a small tarpaulin. White Fang whined as he watched the operation. Later on, two Indians arrived. He watched them closely as they shouldered the luggage and were led off down the hill by Matt, who carried the bedding and the grip. But White Fang did not follow them. The master was still in the cabin. After a time, Matt returned. The master came to the door and called White Fang inside.
"You poor devil," he said gently, rubbing White Fang's ears and tapping his spine. "I'm hitting the long trail, old man, where you cannot follow. Now give me a growl, the last good, goodbye growl."
But White Fang refused to growl. Instead, and after a wistful, searching look, he snuggled in, burrowing his head out of sight between the master's arm and body.
"There she blows!" Matt cried.
From the Yukon arose the hoarse bellowing of a river steamboat.
"You've got to cut it short. Be sure and lock the front door. I'll go out the back. Get a move on."
The two doors slammed at the same moment, and Whedon Scott waited for Matt to come around to the front. From inside the door came a low whining and sobbing. Then there were long, deep-drawn sniffs.
"You must take good care of him, Matt," Scott said as they started down the hill. "Write me and let me know how he gets along."
"Sure," the dog musher answered. "But listen to that, will you?"
Both men stopped. White Fang was howling as dogs howl when their masters lie dead. He was voicing an utter woe, his cry bursting upward in great heartbreaking rushes, dying down into quavering misery and bursting upward again with a rush upon rush of grief.
The Aurora was the first steamboat of the year for the outside, and her decks were jammed with prosperous adventurers and broken gold seekers, all equally as mad to get to the outside as they had been originally to get to the inside. Near the gangplank, Scott was shaking hands with Matt, who was preparing to go ashore. But Matt's hand went limp in the other's grasp as his gaze shot past and remained fixed on something behind him. Scott turned to see. Sitting on the deck several feet away and watching wistfully was White Fang. The dog musher swore softly in awe-stricken accents. Scott could only look in wonder.
"Did you lock the front door?"
Matt demanded.
The other nodded and asked, "How about the back?"
"You just bet I did," was the fervent reply.
White Fang flattened his ears ingratiatingly, but remained where he was, making no attempt to approach.
"I'll have to take him ashore with me."
Matt made a couple of steps toward White Fang, but the latter slid away from him. The dog musher made a rush of it, and White Fang dodged between the legs of a group of men. Ducking, turning, doubling, he slid about the deck, eluding the other's efforts to capture him. But when the love master spoke, White Fang came to him with prompt obedience.
"Won't come to the hand that's fed him all these months," the dog musher muttered resentfully. "And you ain't never fed him after them first days of getting acquainted. I'm blamed if I can see how he works it out that you're the boss."
Scott, who had been patting White Fang, suddenly bent closer and pointed out fresh-made cuts on his muzzle and a gash between the eyes. Matt bent over and passed his hand along White Fang's belly.
"We plumb forgot the window. He's all cut and gouged underneath. Must have butted clean through it, by gosh."
But Whedon Scott was not listening. He was thinking rapidly. The Aurora's whistle hooted a final announcement of departure. Men were scurrying down the gangplank to the shore. Matt loosened the bandana from his own neck and started to put it around White Fang's. Scott grasped the dog musher's hand.
"Goodbye, Matt, old man. About the wolf, you needn't write. You see, I..."
"What?" the dog musher exploded.
"You don't mean to say..." "The very thing I mean. Here's your bandana. I'll write to you about him."
Matt paused halfway down the gangplank.
"He'll never stand the climate," he shouted back, "unless you clip him in warm weather."
The gangplank was hauled in, and the Aurora swung out from the bank. Whedon Scott waved a last goodbye. Then he turned and bent over White Fang, standing by his side.
"Now growl, damn you, growl," he said, as he patted the responsive head and rubbed the flattening ears.
Chapter 2. The Southland. White Fang landed from the steamer in San Francisco. He was appalled. Deep in him, below any reasoning process or act of consciousness, he had associated power with Godhead. And never had the white man seen such marvelous gods as now, when he trod the slimy pavement of San Francisco. The log cabins he had known were replaced by towering buildings. The streets were crowded with perils, wagons, carts, automobiles, great straining horses pulling huge trucks, and monstrous cable and electric cars hooting and clanging through the midst, screeching their insistent menace after the manner of the lynxes he had known in the northern woods. All this was the manifestation of power. Through it all, behind it all, was man, governing and controlling, expressing himself as of old by his mastery over matter. It was colossal, stunning. White Fang was awed. Fear sat upon him. As in his cubhood he had been made to feel his smallness and puniness on the day he first came in from the wild to the village of Grey Beaver, so now, in his full-grown stature and pride of strength, he was made to feel small and puny. And there were so many gods. He was made dizzy by the swarming of them. The thunder of the streets smote upon his ears. He was bewildered by the tremendous and endless rush and movement of things. As never before, he felt his dependence on the love master, close at whose heels he followed, no matter what happened, never losing sight of him. But White Fang was to have no more than a nightmare vision of the city, an experience that was like a bad dream, unreal and terrible, that haunted him for long after in his dreams. He was put into a baggage car by the master, chained in a corner in the midst of heaped trunks and valises. Here a squat and brawny god held sway, with much noise, hurling trunks and boxes about, dragging them in through the door and tossing them into the piles, or flinging them out of the door, smashing and crashing, to other gods who awaited them. And here, in this inferno of luggage, was White Fang, deserted by the master. Or at least White Fang thought he was deserted, until he smelled out the master's canvas clothes bags alongside of him and proceeded to mount guard over them.
"About time you come,"
growled the god of the car an hour later when Whedon Scott appeared at the door.
"That dog of yourn won't let me lay a finger on your stuff."
White Fang emerged from the car. He was astonished. The nightmare city was gone. The car had been to him no more than a room in a house, and when he had entered it, the city had been all around him. In the interval, the city had disappeared. The roar of it no longer dinned upon his ears. Before him was smiling country, streaming with sunshine, lazy with quietude. But he had little time to marvel at the transformation. He accepted it as he accepted all the unaccountable doings and manifestations of the gods. It was their way. There was a carriage waiting. A man and a woman approached the master. The woman's arms went out and clutched the master around the neck. A hostile act. The next moment, Whedon Scott had torn loose from the embrace and closed with White Fang, who had become a snarling, raging demon.
"It's all right, Mother,"
Scott was saying as he kept tight hold of White Fang and placated him.
"He thought you were going to injure me, and he wouldn't stand for it. It's all right, it's all right. He'll learn soon enough.
And in the meantime, I may be permitted to love my son when his dog is not around," she laughed, though she was pale and weak from the fright. She looked at White Fang, who snarled and bristled and glared malevolently.
"He'll have to learn, and he shall, without postponement," Scott said.
He spoke softly to White Fang until he had quieted him. Then his voice became firm.
"Down, sir. Down with you."
This had been one of the things taught him by the master, and White Fang obeyed, though he lay down reluctantly and sullenly.
"Now, Mother."
Scott opened his arms to her, but kept his eyes on White Fang.
"Down," he warned. "Down."
White Fang, bristling silently, half crouching as he rose, sank back and watched the hostile act repeated. But no harm came of it, nor of the embrace from the strange man-god that followed. Then the clothes bags were taken into the carriage. The strange gods and the love master followed, and White Fang pursued, now running vigilantly behind, now bristling up to the running horses and warning them that he was there to see that no harm befell the god they dragged so swiftly across the earth. At the end of 15 minutes, the carriage swung in through a stone gateway and on between a double row of arched and interlacing walnut trees. On either side stretched lawns, their broad sweep broken here and there by great sturdy-limbed oaks. In the near distance, in contrast with the young green of the tended grass, sunburnt hayfields showed tan and gold, while beyond were the tawny hills and upland pastures. From the head of the lawn, on the first soft swell from the valley level, looked down the deep-porched, many-windowed house. Little opportunity was given White Fang to see all this. Hardly had the carriage entered the grounds when he was set upon by a sheepdog, bright-eyed, sharp-muzzled, righteously indignant and angry. It was between him and the master, cutting him off. White Fang snarled no warning, but his hair bristled as he made his silent and deadly rush. This rush was never completed. He halted with awkward abruptness, with stiff forelegs bracing himself against his momentum, almost sitting down on his haunches, so desirous was he of avoiding contact with the dog he was in the act of attacking. It was a female, and the law of his kind thrust a barrier between. For him to attack her would require nothing less than a violation of his instinct. But with the sheepdog it was otherwise. Being a female, she possessed no such instinct. On the other hand, being a sheepdog, her instinctive fear of the wild, and especially of the wolf, was unusually keen. White Fang was to her a wolf, The hereditary marauder who had preyed upon her flocks from the time sheep were first herded and guarded by some dim ancestor of hers. And so, as he abandoned his rush at her and braced himself to avoid the contact, she sprang upon him. He snarled involuntarily as he felt her teeth in his shoulder, but beyond this made no offer to hurt her. He backed away, stiff-legged with self-consciousness, and tried to go around her. He dodged this way and that, and curved and turned.